Okay, we need to resume board meeting at this time. Our next agenda item is a presentation by Department of Fish and Wildlife and Department of Natural Resources staff on northern spotted owl recovery. Darren.
I'm actually second on the agenda. Joe's going to go first, but this is going to be a broad overview with three main parts. Joe's going to cover more of the biology of the owl. I'll talk a little bit about what's happened in the state of Washington and Forest Practices Board's interaction with the owl. And then Andy's going to talk about what's happening currently with the implementation team.
Very good, Joe.
Okay, my name is Joe Buchanan. I'm with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I'm going to be presenting an overview of spotted owl ecology behavior, talking about population trends and things like that. So we've got quite a bit of ground to cover, so I will start right in.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
I request that at least as soon as possible we get a copy of these presentations.
Yeah.
Oh, is there?
Yeah,
okay,
yes,
great.
Thank
you.
Yeah.
I have to look through the sporting version. I just got the other one. Thank you.
Yeah.
My fault.
So, in terms of the presentation, I wanted to talk a little bit about status, but not a lot there. Distribution of abundance in Washington State. Some things about ecology and behavior that are important to know, touch a little bit on limiting factors, and then talk a little bit about what the situation is currently. And that's a photograph of the spotted owl. So real quickly, status, the species was listed in Washington by the Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission in 1988. It's listed in Washington State as endangered. It was then listed under the ESA in 1990 as threatened, and a variety of different specific factors were identified in that listing decision, but the primary sort of higher level factors were loss and adverse modification of habitat and inadequacy of regulatory mechanisms. And there will be a little bit more discussion on some related issues later in the presentation. The spotted owl is well distributed throughout the Cascades and Olympic Peninsula. And so starting first with the Cascades, where the counties come together here is the Cascade Crest. So you can see that there are quite a few spotted owl sites in the eastern Cascades over here. Probably more in the western Cascades, and then they're also quite well represented in the Olympic National Park and National Forest, Olympic Peninsula in general. And then there are very few owl sites in the lower foothills and in southwestern Washington. We've also got owl sites in the southeastern foothills of the Cascades. The green colors on the map are federal lands, and this sort of yellowish green is also federal lands in the adaptive management area. So these are some of the different designations under the Northwest Forest Plan. And then this color actually shows up differently in the key than it is in the map. These are the spotted owl special emphasis areas that are areas identified in the Forest Practices Rules. So the sites that are shown here are the territorial spotted owl sites that really come into play under the Forest Practices Rules. In Washington, we have a little over 1,000 known spotted owl sites that are territory status 1, 2, or 3. So a status 1 site is a pair site. So we know there are two birds there. They're interacting as a pair. Most of these are sites where we've discovered nest sites. Status two is two birds together. We're not sure that they're pairs. They're in some proximity, but we're not quite sure. And then status three is a single bird that is in the area repeatedly, and so its presence is indicating a territorial status. So the important thing that I wanted to convey here is that of the 1,044 sites that were known in the system, and this number has actually been updated a little bit. This number is a couple years old, but it hasn't changed by more than, I think, three or four. So it's pretty close. So we've got 1,044 total sites. And when we look at the spotted owl site center and then the management circle around it, so it's either a 1.8-mile radius circle in the Cascades or a 2.7-mile radius circle west of I-5, only 447 of those sites are exclusively federal. So that means that on the non-federal lands, there are almost 600 of these sites that are either centered on non-federal or centered on federal lands, but the management circle overlaps out to non-federal. And so the non-federal lands in Washington State are important for the spotted owl, and that was one of the reasons for the special emphasis areas being identified in the places where they were located on the previous map. So now into ecology and behavior. Real quickly on habitat. Habitat is thought to function in four ways. It provides for nesting opportunities, roost sites, foraging habitat, and it's also used during dispersal. We don't really know very much about dispersal habitat, but the other three that we understand pretty well. And spotted owl habitat probably is best characterized as structurally complex, mature, and older forest. It isn't strictly old growth forest. It's mature and older forest that has snags, down wood of large size, defective trees, multiple canopy layers. We're really talking about multiple size categories or age cohorts of trees in the forest that create these conditions. There's usually almost always a moderate to high canopy closure. And in the Eastern Cascades in particular, mistletoe is thought to be quite important. Spotted owls do not build their own nests, and so they rely on structures that are available in the forest environment. In western Washington, most nests are either in cavities or in broken top trees. A cavity is actually a hole in the side of a tree. A broken top is the structure that we see here where the tree snapped off, and there's essentially a little platform created in the bole of the tree, usually with some higher areas of the bole extending around it like this that provide protection. And then in the Eastern Cascades, where the conditions are a little bit different, we have nests that are built by other species, oftentimes northern goshawks, but including nests that are situated on clumps of mistletoe-infected branches, primarily in Douglas firs, and sometimes on large flat limbs. Spotted owls have home ranges that are quite large. The home range is a separate, or the home range is the area that they use annually. They defend part of that area, and that's referred to as the territory. So the territory is the area they use primarily during the breeding season. So the annual home range is a much larger area. Washington home ranges are the largest home ranges documented for the northern spotted owl anywhere within its range. They tend to be smaller in southern Oregon and northern California, and the home ranges on the Olympic Peninsula are very large. As you see here, the largest home range was over 27,000 acres based on radio telemetry research.
So is that because of food?
Well, we don't really know that, but it's thought that it's probably related to food because, for example, on the Olympic Peninsula, a lot of those owls were in Olympic National Park, and there's a tremendous amount of mature and older forest there, so it's probably related to changes in food resources. And we know, for example, in Northern California that they use wood rats that are common along ecotones, so edges between forest and clear cuts, and apparently those mammals are incredibly abundant, so there seems to be some indication that's related to changes or differences in prey availability. So on the Olympic Peninsula, that median annual home range of 14,000 acres, so the median is the midpoint in the distribution. So they put radios on a bunch of owls, and they looked at them from smallest to largest, and the owl home range in the middle is the median. So that was 14,000 acres. That is an area the size of a 2.7 mile radius. And in the Cascades, it's the area the size of a 1.8 mile circle. So those are the numbers that are used in forest practices for managing and addressing potential timber harvests and so forth. Okay, now in terms of limiting factors, I place them into two basic groups here. The first being habitat loss, and as you see, it's I've included harvest, fire, windthrow, insects, and disease, and all of those factors under habitat loss have been identified. They've all played out one way or another. We occasionally have fires. Sounds like we've got one burning right now. There were some really big fires back in 1992 that destroyed spotted owl habitat. There have been some windthrow events. There have been windthrow events over the last couple of years in western Washington. So those things happen, and those events impact spotted owl habitat. And then we have these other factors: barred owls, predation, weather, disease. West Nile virus was identified as a possible concern. That really hasn't emerged. There's been quite a bit of research, and apparently it's kind of a non-factor. The barred owl has probably become one of the biggest factors that and timber harvest. I would have to say, though, that we have areas in the state where there hasn't been much timber harvest, and those populations are declining very significantly, so information seems to be indicating that barred owls are important. The ones at the bottom probably are currently not important, but one of the things that we know from other species that are experiencing significant population declines is that when populations become very small, these other issues like predation and weather can then become very important, because when you have a very small population, any kind of disturbance or factor that influences productivity or survival could potentially remove individuals from the population. Now, the current situation, in terms of population performance, the recent demography data that came out in a publication, it's the Studies in Avian Biology, I think it was published in 2011. That information indicates that the populations in these different 11 different study areas are generally not faring well. 7 of the 11 are experiencing declines. And the declines are most significant in Washington and Northern Oregon. And so I've shown the results from the three Washington demography study area population trends as the bottom three bullets there. So the lambda value, that's the little funny symbol after the word pleon, lambda is a measure of population change. And so a lambda value of 0.937 is equivalent to a minus 6.3% change per year. So we can see that all three Washington study areas have lambda values that indicate negative changes in the population from between minus 4.3 to minus 7.1. And these are three studies that have been ongoing for between 20 and 25 years. They're annual studies. This is what a population change of minus 6.3% looks like. And I just started it at a population of 100. This is the population change with Clay Elum study area. I believe they started with slightly fewer than 100 birds, but just for the sake of this demonstration here, I started with 100. So that the Clay Elum study has been going for about 25 years. And so this is essentially what has happened in that landscape. We started with 100 owls, now we're down to 19. So 6.3% per year, that's what it looks like.
Excuse me.
Yes.
So the decline in population you're saying is at the 27-year point now. Is that correct?
I think it's 26 or 27.
Yeah, okay.
Like that.
Okay. So we're at the tail end of this graph, not not the top end looking down.
The graph shows essentially the entire period of that study. And again, I started the population at 100, although their study, I think, is slightly less than that.
Okay. Thank you.
Now, in terms of competition with barred owls, that has become a really significant issue. It really has been significant all along. It didn't probably get quite the attention that was warranted back through the years in different planning arenas. The barred owl arrived in the Pacific Northwest in the 1960s. It expanded its range across the North American continent. Prior to about 100 years ago, it was found essentially east of the Mississippi, and so it has expanded its range quite dramatically. And it now occurs throughout the range of the northern spotted owl, and it's about halfway down the Sierra Nevadas in California, so it's about halfway through the range of the California spotted owl. There have been a number of papers published that indicate that there seems to be a negative effect, negative association of barred owls on spotted owls. And then there are a variety of life history traits that make all of this quite logical. They are habitat and prey generalists, which means that they can use just about any kind of forest habitat, and they can eat just about any kind of food. So what that means is, whereas spotted owls are using structurally complex forest and preying on flying squirrels, primarily, a barred owl can use that same habitat, but also all the habitat around it, as long as it's forest, and they can eat anything. So that and the fact that they have much smaller home ranges, sometimes perhaps as much as only 5% the size of a spotted owl home range, on the Olympic Peninsula, you should, in theory, have 10 or 12 or 15 barred owl territories completely overlapping the spotted owl territory. So there are a lot of them out there, and thirdly, it's easy to understand how they would be competing with spotted owls. They're also great dispersers. Spotted owls disperse about 15 miles on average to the juveniles, whereas barred owls can disperse about 150 miles. So they're rapidly moving through the Pacific Northwest into California, and they also happen to be larger and more aggressive than spotted owls. So in the face of this interaction and concerns about the interaction, the Fish and Wildlife Service recently released Bird Brooklyn Comment, an EIS that outlines some alternatives for conducting removal experiments. The study goals are to facilitate a better understanding of the impacts of barred owls on northern spotted owl populations within the range of the species, or the northern spotted owl subspecies, to allow for assessment of our ability to reduce barred owl populations to a level that permits spotted owl population growth, and to generate an estimate of the cost of barred owl removal, because it'll probably be expensive, and some sort of a feasibility assessment will have to be done after the experiments have been conducted to evaluate whether it's a tool or a process that has further utility. I'm guessing that there will be three study areas. There were several alternatives. I'm a member of the BARDL working group, and we were interacting with the Fish and Wildlife Service, and we essentially made the pitch that three study areas would be appropriate. There's a possibility that one of these areas would be in Washington, but I doubt that would happen. Our spotted owl populations have become so low that we are no longer really good candidate. We don't currently have good candidate landscapes for that kind of project. These are large landscapes. They will involve many, many spotted owl territories, and that's why we don't have great landscapes, because some of our landscapes, for example, the Klee Elm, they only had a handful of spotted owl sites left, and that was identified as one of the sites. It's an experimental design, so there would be treatment areas where removal would occur, and then control areas where no removal would occur, and so it's kind of a classic experimental design. The projects would go for at least 4 years. It requires 4 years to generate the estimates of population change, lambda, that I showed you earlier. And then following that, there would be an effort to evaluate the data and assess feasibility of using experimental or using removal as a management tool, because obviously there would be costs and some other factors to evaluate there. So with this graph, I am showing you the tail end of the previous graph. So the previous graph had 26 years of information showing a 6.3% annual population decline. And so at year 26, I just added another 4 years of information to suggest that the population would continue to decline at about that same rate. And so when the experiments are done, it's assumed that in the landscapes where the barred owls are allowed to remain, that population would continue to decline. And so in that particular landscape, the population would be cleared down to, I don't know, maybe 15 owls. But in the part of the landscape where the removals would occur, we would expect some sort of a population increase. It's anticipated that the spotted owls will respond favorably to the removal of the barred owls. We've got some anecdotal information from Northern California that indicates that exactly that pattern of response will occur. So that's what we're anticipating. Now, that will not be a continuous positive response. There will probably be a leveling off at some point, but that's what's anticipated. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about this barred owl removal experiment, because it's been in the newspaper a lot, and it's a pretty important issue in terms of spotted owl conservation.
Joe? If you were able to achieve that kind of response, would it be necessary, do you think, then to continue barred owl control in those areas to maintain that level of response? Or if you failed to do that, would it just simply fall back down again? I guess it's from a scientific standpoint.
Yes, that's a really good question. I don't think that removal would have to happen annually, but at some point, barred owls are very productive, and they also are very abundant on the landscape. So it seems likely that there would have to be some schedule of continuing removal if this approach were to be taken and used as sort of a standard population management strategy. It might not be annual.
So I have a a little bit different but a somewhat related question, and the effects of barn owls on spotted owls. And so when it comes to more site-specific management and land managers and landowners who are trying to figure out whether or not a spotted owl is present, there has been data to show that there's been a suppression effect on response. Is that true? So if a barn owl was present and a spotted owl was present, it's not always as easy to find a spotted owl.
That's correct.
Right. So, and there, my understanding is correct, there have been some revisions to protocols for trying to detect spotted owls in the presence of barn owls.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about how widely those new protocols have been implemented or tested out, and any observations that people have made based on that?
The spotted owl protocol was an issue of discussion in the barred owl working group, which is a group that the Fish and Wildlife that was brought together. It was identified as one of the recovery actions in the recovery plan. And so we took the available information and had some analysts available to look at some different data sets. A.J. Kroll, Larry Irwin, and others did some analyses of detection rates. And so we had a couple of different data sets that analysts were able to look at and identify response rates as a function of barn owl presence. And so a new protocol was developed. It was put out for 1 year with the idea that people would essentially test it for that 1 year based on, you know, these new ideas that were incorporated into the previous protocol. And what I've heard is that the information coming back indicated that we hit pretty close, and that there, I think, are some minor adjustments that will be made to the protocol. But for the most part, the protocol, I think, was pretty well received. It takes more work now, you know, with barn owls in the landscape. It just requires more survey visits. But I think it was pretty well received. And I think the protocol has been finalized, although I'm not sure about that.
So is what you're saying then, if that new protocol is implemented there, have there actually been instances where spotted owls have been responded after more visits where they wouldn't have under the old protocol?
Actually, I don't know if there are any case studies like that, but there actually are case studies embedded within all these data sets that we look at. So a lot of this information came from demography studies, and sometimes somebody would go back and make an extra visit or something. So we already know that sometimes there are owls out there that are less responsive. They're present, mm-hmm. but they're less responsive. In fact, there are owls that don't respond at all, and the owl surveys find them by seeing them mm-hmm. and not hearing them. So, but I don't think there have been any case studies to look at enhanced detectability based on the new protocol.
Joe, in one of your earlier slides, you indicated there were something over 1,000 sites, federal and non-federal lands in Washington. And then, given the decline in population, I guess the question that I would raise is, of those 1,000 sites, do you have any idea what that number is in terms of how many are actually occupied or populated, given the declines that you've indicated here?
Yeah, that's a difficult question to answer. Based on what we know about the demography study area results, I think it would be safe to say that the population has declined statewide very, very dramatically. However, we do know from some of the pilot work done in Northern California that involved barred owl removal, is there also seems to be this strategy by some spotted owls to sort of lurk or hide out in sort of in the periphery of the territory, such that when the barred owls were removed in these projects in California, literally 2 weeks later, the former resident spotted owls were back at their site centers, at their nests. So I think there are probably some areas where there are still spotted owls that are not responding, but they're sort of hiding out in those territories. But I think there are also numerous areas where the spotted owls are just gone. I can't make an estimate of what I think the population might be, but again, looking at a population that started at 100 on that earlier slide, and by year 30, we're down to about 15. So you know, you can see that in some landscapes, things have changed quite dramatically.
And if, again, if my understanding is correct, that the site center was established because somebody made an observation at some point in time, historically, they may not, those sites may not have been revisited to confirm whether they're still occupied. They may have been, but they may not have been necessarily. So it's not like a continuous history inventory.
Right.
It's a historical evidence, but not a continuous evidence. Is that
right? The 1,044 site centers represents the number of sites that we are aware of in our database from the very first owl site discovered to the most recent. Some of those sites, for one reason or another, are probably no longer occupied, and they may have been essentially abandoned years and years ago for whatever reason. You know, there have been other events, windstorms, fires, etc. And we know that some spotted owl sites, for example, were burned very, very significantly in the 1992 fires in the Eastern Cascades, and so those sites clearly would be represented in this general overall decline.
One quick question. So, using the Olympic Peninsula as an example, you said that you could have 10 barred owls in the same space as a spotted owl. We could be looking at getting rid of hundreds of barred owls to just bring the population up, maybe 10 spotted owls.
Well, we're not sure yet what that threshold value is going to be. For example, in Northern California, we know that the spotted owls return to their site centers, and I think that there are other areas in California, in Oregon, especially southern Oregon, where the two species seem to be in some sort of an equilibrium. So some density of barred owls appears to impact spotted owls. And so one of the things we're hoping will come out of this experimentation is to identify, probably landscape by landscape, what that threshold is, because then that would be the target for continuing removals if that were supported by society. So I can't answer that question specifically because we haven't really discovered what that threshold is. We can't remove all. I think everyone agrees that it's going to be impossible to remove all the barred owls from any of these landscapes. So I think the idea is to try to get the density of those barred owls down to a level that is at or below that threshold. So I'm sorry, I can't specifically.
It seems like a lot of barred owls to get rid of.
Yes, it is. Okay. If there aren't any additional questions, I think we'll just continue on with the next presenter.
Joe, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Practices. Good morning, Board. Darren Kramer, Forest Practices, Division Manager at DNR. Let's see if I can make this work. So as you heard a little bit this morning, the history of the spotted owl in the state is deep and rich with multiple perspectives. And I'm going to emphasize the key word in this slide is overview. So this is going to be a fairly light touch on what's happened in the state. There's lots more detail that you could be provided in the future should you be interested. So a quick touch on the federal actions that have occurred in the state. Moving on to an overview of what's happened at the state level, the board's interaction with the OWL, the two working groups that you heard of this morning, and then a brief mention at the end about next steps. So as you heard from Joe, the federal services listed the OWL in 1990 under the Endangered Species Act, and I think most of you have heard this stuff before from Fish and Wildlife Service, so I'm just going to run through it pretty quickly. When that occurs, when a federal listing occurs, there are specific protections that are triggered under the Endangered Species Act. The prohibition on take without some sort of permit from the services, and the development of a recovery plan. There's also Section 7 consultations that occur. They're required for federal actions, and there's two primary components of those consultations, one being the jeopardy analysis. The feds have to determine if any action would result in jeopardy to the listed species. And the second part, the two-part test, is adverse modification of critical habitat. In order to conduct that second part of the test, critical habitat has to be designated, which we'll touch on a bit later. As you heard from some of the comments this morning, one of the early actions the federal government took was to develop the Northwest Forest Plan. That was initiated primarily in response to the impasse over management of federal forest land within the range of the spotted owl. Finally approved and signed in 1994, adopted a series of reserves and management guidelines intended to protect the owl as well as a whole host of other species. And it's considered the primary pillar of the federal government's strategy for recovery of the owl. As I mentioned earlier, recovery planning is part of a listing. There were three recovery plans written for the spotted owl, the first in 1992, never approved as final. The 2008 version, which was legally challenged and remanded back to the service, ultimately producing the 2011 plan that you heard of this morning and that I think Ken Burke from the Fish and Wildlife Service has presented to you in an earlier meeting. Next step, I think you've also heard from Ken on this, and it's what's prompting this presentation, is the designation of federal critical habitat. There have been two final and one draft designations, 1992 and 2008, that have been released in this latest 2012 draft that was released earlier in the spring. The 2012 proposal includes some non-federal land in the state of Washington within the spotted owl special emphasis areas, and that's different from the previous 1992 and 2008 designations. Since it's draft, there's uncertainty at this point about what it looks like, what it will look like in the end, but we do have a hint of what the federal services are thinking at this moment. The map's a little hard to see, but make this pointer work. There's this color here that looks kind of grayish is actually blue on my screen, and those are areas that are proposed for exclusion. The other colors, there's a couple of shades of green, yellow, and brown in here in these darker colors that are at this time in the draft critical habitat rule proposed as federal critical habitat. The Fed's schedule on this is to have that finalized by November 15th, which triggers an action by the department. And that's referenced there on the slide, 222-16-080, sub 4,
once the federal services designate critical habitat as final within 30 days, board staff, in consultation with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, must submit a recommendation to you regarding that designation. And I'll touch a little bit more on the details of that later on. Important to note that there are differences in critical habitat. There's the federal critical habitat, which I just referred to. And that means the habitat of any threatened or endangered species as designated as critical habitat by the United States Secretary of the Interior or Commerce under the ESA. There's also a critical habitat state, and that's habitat that you folks designate under 222.16.080. So they are different. Moving on to what's happened at the state level, this is an overview of some of the slides that are to come. As you heard from Joe, the Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission listed the owl as endangered in 1988. I have a rulemaking timeline that starts at 1992 up through present that touches on some of the key highlights and key actions the Forest Practices Board has taken. Touch a little bit on the policy working group that was began work in 2009 and completed in 2010, and then Andy will cover the implementation team from 2010 until current. So in 1992, we had a new rule in the section 222.16.080, which is a critical wildlife habitat state in the Forest Practices Rules. That was a 500-acre rule. And so the spotted owl was added to that, a Class 4 special designation for certain forest practices on 500 acres of suitable habitat surrounding the status 1, 2, or 3 activity centers that Joe talked about in his presentation. That rule was intended to be interim while the board obtained the latest scientific information on the owl's habitat needs. The 500-acre rule was amended in the 1993 to 94 time frame to expire in February. An emergency rule was then subsequently adopted with the same language while this other work was going on a permanent rule, and the board's goal for that permanent rule was a long-term viability of the spotted owl in Washington. During the same time frame, the board had commissioned a scientific advisory group to develop a report on spotted owl habitat in Washington and provide management alternatives. There was, I believe, two reports completed on this topic that were completed around this time frame. At the same time, there was lots of other actions occurring, including a challenge by the Department of Wildlife on the 500-acre rule. And so lots of consternation about the 500-acre rule was happening at this particular time while the board was working on a permanent rule. And so there was, I guess, a high desire to get to that permanent rule in this particular time frame. Along 1996, we did move on to a permanent spotted owl rule, which is very similar to what we have today. That was based on a Timber Fish and Wildlife Spotted Owl Policy Group recommendation that included the 10 spotted owl special emphasis areas that you saw earlier, each with different conservation goals. Critical wildlife habitat state was designated for the owl within site center circles within each one of those spotted owl special emphasis areas, which is the Class 4 special trigger. Site centers outside of spotted owl special emphasis areas, Class 4 special is triggered during the nesting season when forest practices are proposed within the 70-acre core area. Another geographic representation of the location of each SOCE in the state. As I mentioned, the SOCEs have different conservation functions and goals with the overarching policy goal to complement the Northern Spotted Owl protection strategies in place on federal land and adjacent to each SOCE. There are three goals, conservation goals identified: demographic support, dispersal support, and a combination of both demographic and dispersal. The maps and the conservation goals
specific to each SOCI are shown in 222-16-086. There are three definitions of spotted owl habitat in the rules: old forest habitat, submature, and young forest marginal, which has some variation between western and eastern Washington, and dispersal habitat. There was some changes to the CEQA authority associated with the 1996 rule change. Substantive CEQA authority for the spotted owl in particular was added into the rules. There was a CEQA exemption for small parcel landowners of 500 acres or less. Some voluntary landscape planning tools were developed, landowner option plans, and cooperative habitat enhancement agreements. Disturbance avoidance was added to the rules, and annual reports to the board on the status of the spotted owl. Jumping ahead to 2005, approximately 9 years after the permanent rule went into effect, the board held, I believe, a two-day workshop on the spotted owl. The impetus for that workshop was the board's adoption of the wildlife work plan. The board committed at that time to review the adequacy of its wildlife rules, and starting with the spotted owl as the highest priority. Department of Fish and Wildlife was asked to assist the board in that effort, and we had a first draft of the briefing report initiated a discussion about owls in the state and experience with the different rules, and this was kind of the format for that two-day workshop. A variety of things occurred at that workshop, lots of presentations by the different caucuses, different agencies, federal and state, a contractor that we had hired to help us along with that effort. Covered things such as the context, historical context for the rule, changes that occurred in habitat on both federal and non-federal lands, demographic studies, the information that's coming out about interaction with barred owls, and the different perspectives from the different caucuses on how the rules were working. That led to some recommendations in November from the various groups that were participating in that workshop on rule changes for lands harvested under habitat conservation plan or other state or federal agreement regarding owls, decertification of site centers, 5-year reports to the board versus the annual reporting. There was a lengthy DNR operational overview of the status of the different circles and how the rules work in those circles. And a stakeholder group was commissioned to take a look at the landowner option plans and the cooperative habitat enhancement agreements to see if there were ways to improve the functionality of those processes so that more landowners would participate. There was discussion and commitments to seek out funding for the Department of Fish and Wildlife to accomplish the landscape level wildlife assessment, which was a key component of the wildlife work plan. Yes.
One other quick thing I wanted to point out about the recommendations at that meeting that I think it's important for, you know, carrying on where we are, is that I believe there was also a recommendation to wait for the completion of the spotted owl recovery plan, or yes, the spotted owl recovery plan, to figure out whether or not existing SOCI boundaries were appropriate.
Yes, thank you. That's correct. Was trying to read, since I wasn't directly involved in a lot of this, I was wading through all the board minutes from these various key points in time trying to figure out, okay, what exactly happened there? And I do remember reading that just this morning, so thank you. So those recommendations led to a couple of things happening in 2006. Rules were amended to note that habitat harvested under one of those voluntary planning actions, such as an ACP or landowner option plan, when they occur, when that land is associated with a SOCI, no longer counts towards the total required habitat that is to be maintained in a SOCI. This was the, some of board members may remember, this was the discussion about the virtual habitat issue, where previously habitat that was allowed to be harvested under an approved plan could be counted towards habitat for another landowner. At this time, the board did away with that. And there was also a rule, as part of that same effort, a moratorium on decertifying site centers. I have an emergency rule there, although it wasn't clear to me from reading the notes from this time frame whether that was actually an emergency rule. It was definitely temporary in nature, but I'm not certain that it was an emergency rule. Along the same time frame, there was the challenge Seattle Audubon versus Sutherland lawsuit filed. The plaintiffs alleged violations of Section 9 of the Endangered Species Act, the sought declaratory and injunctive relief to prevent logging within owl circles. The moratorium I just mentioned was extended a couple of times. In 2008, was extended to the end of the year, December 31st. There was a settlement that occurred associated with the 2006 lawsuit. The settlement agreement required the board to establish a collaborative policy working group, and the board unanimously adopted a motion on July 7th to establish that working group. At this time, there's also an emergency rule that removed the decertification moratorium and established the Northern Spotted Owl Conservation Advisory Group, which is still in existence today. So some of you participated on this group know this very well. In 2009, the policy working group consisting of industry, conservation, state, federal, and local government representatives held over 22 meetings to develop recommendations for the board. There was also some additional adjustments to the rule during the same time frame, and the conservation advisory group that was put in place in the previous slide that I mentioned was the permanent rule was established at this time for that Northern Spotted Owl Conservation Advisory Group for decertifying sites. If you recall, in 2010, the Policy Working Group delivered their final report to the board in February. The report included 7 consensus recommendations and 3 non-consensus recommendations, one of which, one of the more important ones, to establish the Spotted Owl Implementation Team, which is currently at work. And that's the end of my quick overview, and I'm going to turn it over to Andy unless there are any questions.
Just a clarification, this goes back quite a ways, but you can make it whenever you feel like it. There are actually proposed critical habitats on private land outside of Celsius.
In the 2012?
Yes.
Designation?
Yes.
Okay. That's news to me. I wasn't.
I'm very well aware of
Okay. Good clarification. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Andy Hayes. I'm a policy specialist here with the Department of Natural Resources. I'm also the acting chair of the Northern Spotted Owl Implementation Team. I'd like to give you an overview this morning of the implementation team, its origins, its purpose, and our progress thus far. So, as Darren mentioned, following the completion of the policy working group's effort and reports, the board established the Northern Spotted Owl Implementation Team in 2010. This was really the board's attempt to investigate and support voluntary landowner efforts for conservation of Northern Spotted Owl habitat. The motion adopted by the board sort of established, directed the team to do 3 things essentially. The first was to develop a work plan and prioritization of the consensus recommendations that were formed by the policy working group. That second piece was, following a recognition on the part of the policy working group of the significance of barred owls to Northern Spotted Owl conservation, was to continue to coordinate with federal agencies with related to the barred owl working group and the control experiments being conducted. And lastly, to convene a technical team to assess spatially and temporally the allocation of conservation efforts on non-federal lands using the best available science. A The implementation team established was established as a five-member group represented by DNR, Department of Fish and Wildlife, industry, conservation representative, and also representative of a land trust. One of the purposes of the group is to look at incentives, and one of the thoughts there was that a land trust representative would be uniquely qualified to be thinking about the types of incentives that, that work out there in the marketplace. So there are eight components of the work plan. I'm just going to kind of go over each one of them briefly. The first is endorsing a voluntary incentives program for landowners to achieve conservation goals. This is essentially looking at the host of market-based and non-market-based, say, landowner incentive programs, government programs, et cetera, that are sort of looking at all the tools in the toolbox and seeing which ones they can endorse for that might be most effective at achieving voluntary conservation for the North Spotted Owl. Second piece was basically outreach to landowners on the benefits of these type of incentives. This is a piece that we haven't started yet. It's going to come sort of later in the process. Continue to keep ourselves aware of the barred owl control experiments and research that's happening. So we continue to liaise with Joe, as a matter of fact, with the barred owl working group to keep aware of their progress. As Darren just mentioned, the fourth task here was continuing the current decertification process for owl sites during the transition period. That's already been completed. The next task was about the policy working group recommended the use of pilot projects for looking at ways to improve habitat. The work plan calls for the initiation of two pilot projects for thinning in habitat. We have made attempts at projects on both the east and the west side, been met with some challenges as far as funding those projects. We are right now getting off the ground with a project on the east side, which I'll talk about in a little bit here, is moving forward at the moment. Following that, there's this a concept of a flagship incentive project, which is, you know, a landscape level project that would integrate some of the knowledge that had been gained through some of the pilot projects and also through the exploration of incentive mechanisms that would be able to demonstrate the type of how this might work on a larger landscape scale. Looking at adopting measures of success, which the board, the implementation team hasn't attempted yet. And lastly, convening a technical team to assess the spatial and temporal allocation of conservation efforts on non-federal lands using the best available science. So I'm going to highlight two of the tasks which the team has been focused mostly on, and those are number 5 and 8 here. I'll first talk about the technical team. The implementation team went through a process of selecting members for a technical team to look at that task. You can see the representation here. It's well represented. The purpose of the team was to look at non-federal lands and provide some recommendations to the implementation team about which lands might be most advantageous for applying, making voluntary incentive-based efforts, conservation efforts. And so that team has begun that work. They are investigating currently the use of federal models that have been developed by the Fish and Wildlife Service through the implementation of critical habitat designation work to model just for, you know, isolate Washington, look at modeling specifically in Washington where the most conservation benefit might be achieved. And so we are in the early stages of working with Fish and Wildlife Service to understand their models, develop some models that are Washington-centric, and look at some different alternatives for what the future might look like if we made conservation efforts in particular areas. The second large piece of work that the team has been working on is the Eastside Pilot Project. In 2010, the board passed a pilot rule that was designed at exploring whether thinnings of highly stocked stands could be achieved to improve northern spotted owl habitat, both operationally and economically. So as to demonstrate their feasibility. The goal here was to improve habitat while creating incentive for landowners to actually engage in those types of activities. The project area that was identified in the pilot rule is in eastern Washington in the Entiat SOCI. It's located in a couple sections owned by Longview Timber. We've been working closely with them on this project. The project area, as I said, these two sections, it's about 1,200 acres. And the pilot rule stipulated that activities could happen on up to about 640 acres of those 1,200, so about half of the area. So we have convened a project team to work on this that includes the landowner and includes stakeholders. We've done some initial looking at those sections and are putting together plans to go out in the field later this month to do a field visit, look at some of these different stands, start to calibrate some of our thinking among the scientists on this team about what these different stands look like and what type of treatments might be appropriate in those stands. Following that, we are going to hopefully move forward with developing some prescriptions and also finding funding to support this effort. Just before I hand it back over to Darren, so we, as you may know, we continue to work on these tasks. We meet on a regular basis with both the implementation team and some of the supporting technical groups that have been working with them. We'll continue to be reporting back to you at each of your meetings on our progress. Thank you.
I have one quick question.
Please.
You talked about the decertification process. So basically no owls are in those areas. Is that the Entiat project, one of those, so that we could go back in and bug kill and disease dying to help with wildfire and forest management? Is that going to be able to be statewide in these SOCIs that no longer have owls in them?
So I think that, Darren, you might be better qualified to speak on the decertification process.
Yeah, the moratorium on decertification was lifted, but we have in place a process to go through when a landowner decides they want to pursue decertification. It involves that Northern Spotted Owl Conservation Advisor Group that I mentioned in my slides earlier. So there is a process in place.
Okay.
It's unrelated to the pilot project that Andy was talking about.
Okay.
Does that make sense? I can
follow up with you. Yeah, I'm just curious if there's no owls in some of these areas because their population has dropped. Is there a way that we can go in and manage them so that we don't end up in Kittitas County with them totally all gone, or bug kill that would eventually go to fire? I mean, instead of letting them just stay there and not ever be able to be logged, can we do something with them to avoid?
There are a number of landscape planning tools that are available and have not been widely used, but there are state level tools as well as federal level tools that might work for individual landowners. Some have taken advantage of those, such as the landowner option plans, the cooperative habitat enhancement agreements, or something like an ACP or a safe harbor agreement, those sorts of things. So those sorts of efforts, planning tools can be used to allow management within habitat. There is the decertification process at the state that a landowner has to go through that in order to decertify a site.
Okay, thank you.
Is it
Darren?
Sorry, I wanted to clarify really quickly on the pilot rule. I mean, there is some relation to what you're talking about in terms of providing even more tools to be able to go in and do some management where owls actually still exist. And the whole point behind the pilot was to try to take a look at, might there be a way to approve some prescriptions for thinning in spotted owl habitat that would then be have a sort of positive results after the thinning, and then instead of a landowner needing to go through the CEPA process and do an environmental impact statement to be able to get approval to do that thinning, there would be some pre-approved approaches. That's one goal of trying to get in this pilot process, to see if we can get to that point where there'd be pre-approved approaches that landowners could use to then do some management where there's forest health or overstocking. And then it wouldn't take as long, it wouldn't be as expensive as some of the current processes are.
Thanks for the clarification, Joe.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up to this question about dry forest management. The Fish and Wildlife Service also put together a dry forest working group as one of the recovery actions, and that group has been, it hasn't met for a while, but it discussed different kinds of management strategies to address fire risk, forest health, and so forth. And some of the information that has come out of the scientific community in the last several years via some different research projects and modeling efforts is that it is possible to substantially reduce fire risk in particular by strategically managing the landscape. And the Forest Service is currently working on a model. I believe it's the Oregon State University office working together, or I think Field Station Research Lab, working together with the folks over in the Wenatchee office on this model that will look at different configurations of patches, owl habitat, and the way that strategic timber harvest or other kinds of activities can reduce the risk of a small fire becoming a large fire in those landscapes. So there is an attempt and an effort currently underway to try to figure out if there are certain kinds of patterns, patch sizes, levels of contiguity that we can manage for that still allow for owls in the landscape, but at the same time substantially reduce that fire risk. So those efforts are underway.
All right, so what's next? As I think most of you know, you have the next board meeting scheduled on November 13th. November 15th is the scheduled release of the final critical habitat rule. Uncertain if the Federal Services will meet that date, but it's my understanding they are trying hard to meet it. And they are, in fact, I think, court directed to meet that date. Whatever the date ends up being for the release of the final federal critical habitat rule, within 30 days of that, DNR in consultation with DFW will need to deliver a recommendation to the board. And this is regarding what staff thinks the board needs to do in response, if anything. So that's where we are right now. Some discussion, you might want to have some discussion about the sequencing of events here, given that the federal critical habitat will likely come out after the board meeting. I'm guessing they won't come out before. And so we will need to, within 30 days, respond. We can certainly prepare a memo and ship it to you, and you can take it up at the next board meeting. You could schedule a special meeting. There's a variety of options, but that is for you folks to discuss and consider.
Questions for the panel before we turn the lights back on and talk about what's next. Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Just a really quick question. I know the answer to this, but I think it is important to maybe the daylight, and that is when the feds released the critical habitat rule, it's a final rule, and it may or may not include non-federal lands. Right now, the critical habitat is proposing to exempt non-federal lands that have conservation agreements like HCPs, etc. They are considering exempting all non-federal lands, all state and private lands, from the critical habitat designation. So regardless of where they come down in terms of non-federal lands, I believe it is still, once that final rule comes out, I believe the requirement is for us to consult my agency with DNR and DNR to provide our information to the board, is there regardless of whether or not state and private lands are included? Is that correct?
That's correct.
So I guess my only point is that that schedule is true whether or not, you know, no matter what the critical habitat rule says. And it's always, in past experience, a really big workload to, within 30 days, provide, you know, do that consultation between the agencies and provide a meaningful recommendation to the board. It's not an easy task. And so in the past, and I'm not saying it will happen again, but in the past it's kicked off a lot of discussion, regardless of whether it was owls or anything else, at the board level. So that's why DNR put together, and rightfully so, this big presentation today to get everybody tuned up on what's going to be coming down.
Clarification also in process. Following, whenever the critical habitat rule is actually released, and within that 30 days, DNR and Department of Fish and Wildlife prepare a report to the board. The board then still has options as to whether they take action or don't take action, or take one kind of action or a different kind of action. So that's a process that is triggered, I guess, by your 30-day report, but is not necessarily determined or dictated by that report. Yeah, is that correct?
There's the 30-day requirement upon staff to provide its recommendation to the board, but there's no clock or requirement upon the board to take action in response to that. That's at the board's discretion.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. One thing I did want to mention, I'd be remiss if I didn't. I want to acknowledge Ms. Lauren Burns, who's staff to the implementation team. She did most of the work in preparing at least my presentation. So it wouldn't be here if it wasn't for her. So I want to acknowledge her and thank her for that.
Thank you, Lauren.
Thank you.
So one of the topics that I understand has been discussed by the board recently is the idea of whether the board would convene a committee of the board to take up what response the board should have and alleviate the workload on the entire board. Have a committee take it up. You two discuss that.
That sounds better.
And I have, in conversations with some of you over the last week and a half, in conversations with representatives from stakeholder organizations, I think there's broad support for that idea. And the questions are, at what time would it be most appropriate to put that committee together and get it moving, given still a bit of uncertainty with the federal timeline and exactly what emerges from the federal process, and then what type of a purpose or a charter would we put on that committee to get its work moving in the right direction? I think that's where the conversation needs to be had. I'm sensing pretty broad support for the notion of a committee to take up this important matter. Your comments and thoughts?
So one thing I wanted to lay before the board for discussion is that, you know, certainly the critical habitat rule is one driver for us to be talking about this, but the topic of the current status of our rules, whether or not they're adequate to their original purpose, what to do based on the release of the final recovery plan last summer, and then how we respond to the recommendations about policy work group provided, and then perhaps how to, encourage and incorporate ongoing work of the Spotted Owl implementation team. It seems like there are a variety of reasons that a board committee would be a good idea. And some thoughts I had about that is, incentives are important. And sometimes rules are needed to encourage the use of incentives or to support them. So that could be one task of a board subcommittee. So rather than putting that task on the implementation team itself, because they're hard at work, directing the actions of a technical team, they're hard at work trying to figure out what sorts of non-regulatory or perhaps even regulatory incentives might be helpful to landowners, that a subcommittee of the board itself could go through a systematic examination of the rules to say, okay, this is, based on previous reviews or based on new reviews, this is what works well from a landowner's perspective, this is what works well from a conservation perspective, and compare to the original purposes of the rule. And these might be some areas that need to be tweaked. I mean, Darren mentioned a couple of committees that were formed in 2005, 2006 to streamline the use of landowner option plans or property habitat enhancement agreements. Those committees, as far as I understand, never really completed their work or never provided recommendations to the board that could be taken up again. And then there really still is this question that's been lingering out there of whether or not the existing SOC boundaries are appropriate given the status of the population. Given the fact that the current rules do allow for elimination of entire territories, and does that make sense? Given the population status, given the fact that some of our rules are the board made a decision that the forest practice rules in terms of aquatic species should be consistent with the Endangered Species Act, and that the entire rule set should have an incidental take permit. And we don't have an equivalent structure for spotted owls or even other upland species. So asking the question, does it make sense to consider a programmatic statewide HCP for spotted owls? I mean, there's lots of new questions that the board committee could take on. It could be done systematically, it could be done in public eye. It doesn't have to be rushed, I wouldn't think. So that would be my recommendation, is yes to have a committee, and yes to think very carefully about answering a lot of these questions that have been lingering before the board for quite a few years now.
Other views on this from board members?
I'm just questioning for Paula. Are you envisioning a standing committee then? Or? Not be limited on date?
I think a committee should have a timeline, just one that's not overly rushed. I think there should be an end date in which the subcommittee made recommendations to the full board and not have the idea of it being continuous. Because to me, that could just lead to us maybe doing more work than we need to, or not getting to decisions. I'm not sure.
Dave? I guess kind of from a higher level, critical habitat is a little ways off, so to me it seems maybe a little premature for if a committee was going to focus on, so what do we do with critical habitat, because we don't know yet. We could maybe get educated about what kind of possibilities might happen and all these scenarios, but that might be kind of a waste of time at this point. But a committee or subcommittee could take up some of these issues that Paula spoke of, in addition to kind of just even a more in-depth understanding of how the current rules work and why they're developed, and beyond what we heard today, in order to provide that foundation for when the critical habitat rule is released. And then the kind of the outlier of that is that if critical habitat does not include non-federal lands, and so then the question is then what? So then what does the committee do? So I guess I see some value in providing that kind of smaller group to provide that foundation for board understanding as we move forward. We kind of gravitate or potentially could kind of go between just what do we do with the critical habitat to then assessing the whole current rule system. And so there's a bit of a gray area there about what the role of that committee is, and I think that's one thing that would need to be discussed.
Okay.
Is it just critical habitat? Is it the whole rural assessment? Is it, you know, what do we need? Is it, you know, just kind of exactly what the scope is?
I agree with David that I think it may be just a little bit premature until we see what comes out with the critical habitat final designation. A committee structure is maybe the most efficient way to work through this, but I'm not sure that any board member should be exempt from having to struggle through these issues. I say that only somewhat facetiously.
Because you know that you would be involved in the committee.
I guess it makes some sense to me to sort of preload this, and we kind of know the range of options, the range of scenarios that we're faced with, and uploading it, I think, makes some sense to me. Of course, I don't want to be on the committee.
You say you don't want to be?
Yeah,
you
don't want to be. No.
You can't make that recommendation. You're disqualified.
No, but I'd support it. I think it's worked well in the past, sort of through some of these issues and with a smaller group and stakeholders. So we know whether there's private lands or state lands or not federal lands involved or not, we still have some issues that need to be worked through. So that's
important. I might share with the commissioners and my thought on it. It's not dissimilar from all of your comments. We're not inclined to actually try to create the committee today and get the committee functioning right now. Some of the conversations that I've had over the last week and a half with some of you and with representatives of stakeholder organizations suggest that there are some differences in the perspective between how much the committee should be emphasizing just the critical habitat proposal versus the broader topics. To what extent do we want the committee looking at regulatory changes versus remaining with some fidelity to the incentives work that's going on? And I think the time between now and November could be very profitably spent to try to have some additional dialogue, to get these balances better understood, help do the homework that we could use to build a good purpose statement, a good charter, and then be a lot more ready to take this up in November. We'll know if the federal timeline is halting. We'll have more cards turned over for us to look at. Our thought is to pursue the committee in November and not try to create it at this point.
Dave? But I also heard some thought between now and then about the charter and the scope and potentially more committees.
I think we could explore that in some fashion leading to the board taking up the committee idea in November.
So who is we?
Staff to the board. I'm looking at you, Darren.
We is him. So you're suggesting that our next board meeting, staff would bring forward, after consulting with folks, what a charter might be for a committee that we...
I would recommend that the board takes up and makes its decision on whether to create the committee and exactly how to task that committee in November, but that we use staff and some of our own work in the interim to get ready to have that decision in November. Sound possibly a way to go, and I don't think we need a motion from the board to do that, but rather we work in that manner up to the November meeting.
Yeah.
Sound like a way to go?
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that.
Okay. Well, thanks again to staff for a good presentation today to get us partially up to speed, get this up and moving in the right direction, and thanks for a good dialogue around this. And we'll use the time between now and November profitably and get ourselves ready to take some action, make a decision in November. And with that, we're finished about 20 minutes early on the morning portion of our agenda. So we could either advance the start of our afternoon session or take an extra 20 minutes for our lunch break. What's your preference?
Advance.
So why don't we...
Well, the only comment I would make, and we've heard this before at various times, is that you have public comments scheduled next, and there may be some that are planning to be here after lunch to have that public comment, and we may be excluding them if we advance the...
Okay.
Unless there's some other portion that we could advance without violating that, I would suggest we take lunch early.
Okay. Darren, your thoughts on that matter? On whether we run the risk of crunching the public comment period if we tried to move our afternoon start up to 12:30?
Yeah, we've just started that in the last couple of meetings about that after lunch comment period. I would suggest leaving it at that time. We can move up one of the agenda items. Ms. Jamison is not here. She was scheduled later, but I could move on the settlement agreement topic if that works.
Okay. So why don't we do that? We'll start again at 12:30, but do some rearrangement of the afternoon agenda items so we maintain that 1 o'clock slot for public comment. Okay, see everybody back at 12:30, and we're in recess until then.